This is the Change Management Podcast by the University of South Wales. My name is Jonathan Deacon, Professor of Marketing in the School of Design, Digital and Marketing, and I'm joined by my colleague Phil Harfield from the Faculty of Creative Industries. Phil is an expert in design thinking. Hello, Phil.
Hi, Jonathan. Really looking forward to our conversation.
In Season 3, we're exploring the concept of design thinking, how it can apply to business and how it works in practice. We discuss how design thinking can help any organisation become an agile one. In this episode, we cover tactics and strategies for creating impact by design inside your organization, with thoughts on measuring its value and aligning design to business outcomes. To do that, we would welcome our guest, Adam Fletcher. Adam is director of the British Heart Foundation in Wales. Hello, Adam.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Good for you to be here and help us with some of our conversation. Okay then, Phil, what is this human-centered approach? What does a human-centered approach mean in business?
Fundamentally, it's about our expectations, us as consumers, us as business participants, are our expectations being met and hopefully exceeded, going beyond our expectations? Or is there a disconnect really between our experience of being a customer and perhaps the company perspective of us as customers? So I suppose an example we might all have of perhaps buying something online, perhaps buying online furniture, for example. When we're browsing the internet, we might see an array of features, array of options, and be sort of confronted and have sort of choice fatigue around these options. But when we're selecting that item, we might measure a room and see it doesn't fit and have more sort of disgruntled experience. When we're going through the purchasing online, we might think, oh, have we got a discount code? How do I book a delivery slot? Do I have to assemble this thing myself? Is there customer support for this? So I think that kind of expectations of, might I regret this purchase and never again go to this retail outlet?
So this is about putting a human being, a human's kind of emotional needs and desires and approach right at the center of everything that we do within the organization. I've read somewhere that it's about head and hands approach to business.
Yeah, and I think it's the transparency of that, isn't it? So that when I say disconnect, I mean business people, business owners, are we aware of these? Or do we make a lot of assumptions based on we've designed this product, we've designed this service, we've designed this experience as we see it, but from the different perspective, from the user perspective, it is a completely different animal to how we perceive it. So I think it's checking our assumptions on this is really what user-centered and user-centered thinking is all about.
No, I'm intrigued today because our guest, Adam, comes from an organization where I guess, you know, initially we would just assume that it's human-centered. It's the British Heart Foundation. But I guess you're running a business as well. So how does a human-centered approach, what does that mean to you and your organization?
Yeah, I think it's absolutely vital that charities like British Heart Foundation actually adopt a human-centered design approach, because everything we do is about trying to improve outcomes for patients, trying to improve people's lives, save lives in terms of funding research and also all the information and support that we provide for people. Everything we do is people powered, the way we raise money, the way people support us and fundraise as well. And this is something we're trying to do because if we're not going to deliver our mission and improve people's lives, if what we're providing for them isn't what they want and what they need and doesn't provide that kind of level of support. And I think it's absolutely key. And it's the same from a fundraising perspective. People are not going to support us and raise money if they can't easily sign up to fundraising challenges, if they don't enjoy them, if they don't fit in terms of the routines of them and their families and so on. So yeah, it's absolutely vital for charities to employ this thinking now.
I'm interested, I'm sure our listeners are interested, in getting a picture of the organisation that British Heart Foundation in Wales is. But what does it look like? What are the elements of that business? You've mentioned fundraising, and I guess we might all recognise people go for, you know, runs and cycle rides and so on to raise cash. Give us the other side of that coin there. What's the bigger picture? What does this organisation look like?
I suppose the easiest way of thinking about big charities like the British Heart Foundation, I suppose, is essentially we're a platform between kind of people who want to do something good and then people who, you know, we want to help, people who are living with heart and circulatory diseases. From a fundraising perspective, we try and make it as easy as possible for people to support us in lots of different ways. So we have lots of shops. If people want to donate goods or volunteer their time, we run a lot of events. people can do fundraising challenges on their own or in their communities. So we try and offer a range of different fundraising activities. And obviously, we also kind of encourage businesses to support us. It's not always individual people as well. And in terms of how we spend that money, we're the biggest funder of cardiovascular research in the UK. That's our kind of main mission. So we spend a lot of money on research to try and find better ways of detecting and preventing and treating heart disease in the future. And we also put a lot of resource into trying to support patients through our helpline, through the information we provide online. We provide CPR training. So we provide a very broad range of activities, both to generate money and in terms of how we spend that.
And I guess the business angle then is that generation of funds, isn't it? I mean, yeah. give us a ballpark figure if you have it. How much money do we need to raise in Wales to keep your organisation going from year to year?
Before the pandemic, we were raising about £150 million a year across the UK and spending over £100 million a year on research. And we would typically raise, you know, actually more than kind of per capita in Wales. So we'd be raising nearly £10 million a year in Wales. You know, our fundraising and retail incomes here have taken a huge hit in the last couple of years. But yeah, we'd be raising up to £10 million a year in Wales.
And I think that's important to paint that picture here and now, because what it signifies to me is that third sector, okay, charitable organization, okay, but actually strip away some of those external kind of facing features and you've got a sizable organization that's doing good. And human-centered approach, Phil, is about doing good things, yes?
Oh, absolutely. I think the moment you put the people in the middle and what are the problems, what are the issues that you face as anyone faces, you know, we've all got a shared experience over the last 18 months of going through something that we wouldn't have been able to predict, wouldn't have put in our risk models on our wall charts. So I think the human experience of going through that really exemplifies how we kind of need to put people at the center of all our decision-making, not just business decision-making. But I think that's the real, how Adam's talking about not-for-profit or charity-based business, you know, the idea of the spectrum of businesses from at one end, the traditional business, the for-profit business, and at the other end, I guess, the purely charity business. But this big area in the middle that's kind of this mission-driven organisations, is perhaps values-led rather than value-led organisations. And that's a real growth area, really, in terms of how you engage with your audience. What's that conversation you're having with those people who are trying to put the centre for the British Heart Foundation? Is the clinical outcomes is the mission, and how do we support that? So I think for businesses, it's finding that purpose is part of the how the traditional businesses are reinventing their business to a certain extent.
And what's important here, I think, is that within the Change Management podcast series, you know, we're discussing things which can be applied and are applicable to all sorts of organisations, all sorts of sizes, and you know, across a spectrum of geographical positioning.
Want to empower your teams to think differently and solve complex problems? Start your design thinking journey today. Search USW Design Thinking.
Now then, Adam, we've had, you know, particularly interesting, to say the least, year and a half. Goodness knows how much longer things are going to be disrupted, I suspect, for a long time to come, and maybe positively. But what are your challenges then at the British Heart Foundation?
Yeah, I mean, the pandemic's probably the biggest challenge British Heart Foundation's faced, you know, in the last 60 years. I mean, there was two big impacts of the pandemic. I suppose one was the financial one that I've talked about. We had over 700 shops that were shut, I think, for over 8 months of the last financial year, sort of 8 out of 12 months. All major fundraising events have been cancelled, marathons, half marathons, huge impact on basically our fundraising model. We don't get any money off the government. We're a charity which is, you know, entirely people powered. I mean, our supporters have always funded what we do. So that's had a huge impact. Our income's dropped by about half, you know, since the pandemic. And of course, that means that we can't fund as much research. The amount we're funding in terms of research has dropped by about 50% as well. So the other big impact is that at the same time as kind of having less money, there's been more demand than ever from patients for information and support. I think in March last year, I think the helpline calls went up 400% pretty much overnight. We've had over 5 million people access information on our COVID hub. Lots and lots of people with heart and circulatory diseases have got lots of questions about what COVID-19 meant for them. And there's also a lot of people who are waiting a long time for treatment at the moment now because of the backlog of care in the NHS, who are coming to us wanting advice, wanting to know what they should do.
You put all that into place, I guess, relatively quickly, because you didn't know the pandemic was going to come along, you know, like everyone else. It was a, you know, a bit of a surprise. So how do you manage then the people inside your organization? How did you manage that process? How did you allow people to innovate and problem solve as quickly as was required? All businesses, and I think we need to state this here, all businesses needed to react quickly. Some did, some didn't. And we can see on the high street the consequences of those that didn't. But in your organization, you know, people are going to look to you for those answers to their circulatory, their heart issues and so on. So you had to work, you know, I guess pretty quickly to solve those problems. How did you do it?
We set up a program pretty quickly as soon as the pandemic hit. It was called our Patients First program. And basically, we just wanted to put patients first at that time. We knew that we were struggling to kind of meet the demand on the helpline. And we knew that people had a lot of questions. So it was a kind of a cross-organizational group and that myself and others were interested in. We did use some explicit design thinking methods. We used things like minimal viable products to test things because, of course, we were very uncertain about what might work. So we tried to understand very quickly what are the main questions that people are asking over and over again, and provide videos on the website answering those questions to try and reduce the demand on the helpline. If lots of people have got a similar question, we're trying to reduce that demand. And we set up a COVID hub online where we tried to answer lots of common questions that people had. And the other thing we did that we had to respond to quickly was services such as cardiac rehabilitation services obviously shut down immediately. But we know that services like that are vital. When people have had a heart attack, it's really important as part of their recovery that they can access some sort of rehabilitation. And that's where, you know, and healthcare professionals in the NHS really needed us to maybe help there. So what we did there was to try, and this is where you'll get some really good innovation out of COVID. So we've developed, and this needed to happen, a better online cardiac rehabilitation journey for people who, lots of people probably never wanted to go to the local hospital or leisure center to take part in cardiac rehab classes before. And we've now curated a whole journey that people can do online. And we did that, you know, initially it was a very, very, very crude product. We've seen how that's popular. We've seen what bits of it people liked. And now we've filmed a kind of a complete cardiac rehabilitation journey, which will launch on our website for people to follow in both English and Welsh language versions, actually. And I think those are where some good innovation will come out of it.
Yeah, yeah. So, Phil, Adam's there talking about initially, you know, observation, learning from the users that are using the system that are coming in asking those questions. And from that, then, I think what we might call in design thinking, we're prototyping ideas, test bedding them, running them through, seeing what's happening. Am I right in that? And Adam mentioned MVP. Can you tell us a little bit about what that means?
So I think the COVID spotlight as, I guess, a remarkable sort of innovation trigger, or I guess we talk flippantly like terms of pivoting your business and resilience and diversification as innovation drivers. But I think experience of actually going through to fulfill those needs of our customers. So the people that are essentially the relationship to the NHS might have shifted dramatically. They're looking for external providers of information, you know, trusted sites, trusted information. So where do they go to? So I think, you know, the idea of charities and third sector as trusted sites, trusted sources of information, I think is an interesting, I guess, role. I'll probably have a question for Adam about, does he see it as his role, a role shift or a permanent shift to the role of relationships in the NHS? I think in answering, I guess, the idea of testing and rethinking, like you say, that's fundamental to embracing failure in a way. So testing in a low-risk environment, ideally in a soft environment where you're not going to risk the relationships, damaging relationships with your customers or your stakeholders. So, but COVID has meant we couldn't do that. We didn't have that luxury. So, you know, pop-up food banks and reclaiming vacant housing to house people, crowdsourcing kind of hardship funds, or online medical consultation, you know, it's all happened at such a rapid pace. We haven't really done that, I guess, process of testing and validating. And that's where I think design thinking perhaps can be criticized as saying, well, if it's a formalized process, but when the need is so urgent, how do you react quite quickly? So that kind of iteration, which is fundamental to design thinking, is where we're doing it. So we're testing things quickly. We're getting feedback quite quickly. We're understanding the flaws and getting and reinventing that product. So time frames of building a website, building, of 6 months of to validate it, then refreshing it every 6 months. So that hasn't happened. So in essence, there will be negative impacts on our experiences of being consumers or to the other side of the screen to some of this stuff. But that's what we've had to do it that way, really.
Okay. And Adam, just picking up on Phil's question there, coming back to you on that, the idea that your role may have changed, your relationships with stakeholders has changed in the last 18 months or so?
I mean, I wouldn't necessarily say it was, it was a complete pivot for us. We were always an organization that funded research and supported patients and healthcare professionals. I guess the balance of activity changed certainly last year, and we were trying to put patients and healthcare professionals first when the pandemic hit. And that's been good because it's allowed us to develop new partnerships with people to improve our helpline, to improve the information we provide online. And it's challenged us to think about it, think about how we can do it as effectively as possible to make sure we're led by the data. I think one big difference going forward as well as what Phil's talked about, the number of people, older people who are now kind of digitally competent, for want of a better word, has obviously grown. I think the concern in the past, so to use the cardiac rehab at home digital resources that we're developing now, I suppose in the past we might have been concerned, well, will we, miss people, potentially exacerbate existing inequalities if we offer too much support digitally? And I think that risk as well, is reduced now, which also supports innovation for charities like ourselves and also for the NHS.
And I think that whole conversation, well, there's two elements to what you've just said, actually, which I think are a part of a bigger conversation about digitally enabled consumers and customers and that acceleration of digital uptake. And also telemedicine in some way, either soft or hard telemedicine. Soft telemedicine being kind of the advice things that you're doing, and the hard one, computers operating 3,000 miles away from the robot that's operating on a real human being. I mean, I think we have come an awful long way, and I suspect, for me, and correct me, gents, if I'm wrong, but I think for me that there has been an awakening that actually the digital world and the human being and the human being at the center of that digital world, rather than just digital being at the center of the digital world, if you see what I mean by that, but I think we have gone that towards that human-centered kind of approach. Phil, what are your thoughts on that?
So the idea of like the technology-led innovation or technology leading us to this better world is obviously a big driver for everything. So, but where I suppose it, from my perspective, where it perhaps conflicts from this so human-centered aspect, or the values-led or the social enterprise or the mission-driven, I think is, where is it leading us to? So the idea of technologies for technology's sake, companies that perhaps have incremental improvements to their technology to make us buy the latest features or the latest improvements to the camera on our phone, for example. I think this is where, organizations will overlap in, they'll be enabled by technologies. They'll be enabled to improve the customer experience through the technologies, but they won't necessarily be driven by technologies. And I think that's kind of a red flag for companies that perhaps are operating purely in that zone of that traditional business spectrum being led by the technology. Are they considering the human factors? Are they considering the social experience of using that technology? What is the purpose? What is the impact of that? What is the mission that you're conforming to by putting that on the marketplace? I think that's where my research sort of aspect is really interesting, how businesses are evolving this kind of conjoined version of a value-led, values-led, and a technology-led kind of business approach.
And for me, there's an element there of purpose. What's the purpose? What are we doing this for? And, British Heart Foundation, absolutely. You spoke earlier on, Adam, about its kind of rationale and the reason why it's there. It's purpose. If you've got a purpose that everybody can sign up to, and both inside and outside the organization, you know what it's about. I think that does make life a lot easier. And it surprises me in my consulting activities how few companies actually have a well-articulated purpose I think they know what they're about, but they don't really communicate that particularly well. And I think that would be particularly valuable for business development and for developing a better customer experience and so on. And thinking of that experience, Phil, how can we begin to gain that in-depth understanding of the user's needs? What are the tools in our design thinking toolbox to enable us to do that?
Well, I think the key kind of phrase there is that in-depth, and I guess the risk of having a shallow understanding, and it's kind of a dangerous place to be. So that's where it's always research-led. So the investment in upfront research is really what design thinking is about. So to understand, you know, the value is what's the winning idea is based on our understanding to the benefit that idea is bringing. So validation is really key. So how do we check our thinking on these things? I guess one of the long-standing approaches around thinking is, you know, using a logic-based model, making a decision based on facts and evidence. And I guess we know that this isn't necessarily the best place to be. So there's an understanding that abductive thinking.
Yes.
I think that's the word. I think we need abductive thinking. So if we base our decisions purely on a logic, you know, if you think about an observed situation such as, oh, humans are very kind to turkeys. And we're monitoring the situation. Yes, they're still very kind to turkeys, but this kind of model only applies until, you know, Christmas Eve. So I think generating theories and behaviors and decisions based on a logic model, on the evidence you see, isn't necessarily a correct one. So a lot of design thinking says we need this abductive way of looking at things. So we're generating a theory. We're testing that conclusions so that we might build that theory around that theory. And we're not going to that trap of responding perhaps purely to the visible things, you know, the things on the top of the iceberg that we see, not necessarily the undercurrents and the behaviors of people that are pushing that thing in a certain direction. So I think, yeah, abductive thinking is a good thing.
And British Heart Foundation in Wales, Adam, do you have a structured way of looking for that in-depth understanding, or does it happen, you know, does it by osmosis, or you just observe things and you make sense of that? You know, do you have a plan for gaining that data and getting that understanding?
We have sort of systems in place for certainly trying to collect data and understand sort of patients and healthcare professional needs that, you know, they exist both at the kind of population level. You know, we're always trying to understand where is there an increase in prevalence. So, for example, heart failure is a condition which has really increased in prevalence over recent years. As you know, fortunately, more people survive heart attacks, but that leaves many more people living with heart failure. And that's it. So we're always trying to understand these big population trends. We're also trying to listen to patients and NHS staff directly as well through our kind of public and patient involvement groups. We try and analyze the helpline data that we have and the information we have online as well to understand what are people coming to us for. So for example, in the last week, you know, last couple of weeks, we've seen a 2,000% increase in people coming to our website for information about CPR training and defibs after their Christian Eriksen cardiac arrest. Straight away, you know, we're going to look to that. We're going to foreground that information. We're going to think, how can we provide even more information to people at the moment about that? So we're always looking for trends, you know, both at that big level, but also you have to listen to people. One healthcare professional, one patient can also give you a really good nugget of information as well to really spark an idea as well.
So it's about listening, and it's about observing, and it's about maybe acting a little bit on intuition too, perhaps, in this. I've thoroughly enjoyed our conversation today. But before we go, let's have just a short sentence off both of you, a sentence of advice to listeners. What advice would you give to organizations that need to better develop solutions with a human-centered approach? What would you say to them? Phil, let's start with you first.
Well, I'm definitely going to steal Adam's thunder here and say the listening to people is really key. And I think he said, you know, what are people asking us for? So if you've got this kind of reflective questioning of what you're doing as an organization, are you answering those needs? How are we meeting those needs? I think you're really onto a good start to being a human-centered organization.
Thank you. And Adam, finally.
Yeah, in addition to that kind of listening and responding, I think my advice would be to sort of collaboration and to work in partnership, I think is really important for charities. I think there's a temptation to sometimes develop new products or services on your own and want to kind of do that and keep it secret. But actually working particularly with businesses, I think is one of the things which really helps charities apply design thinking. It forces you to articulate what your challenges are and what you want to do by working with an external partner, because you have to explain to them what you want to do first of all. They obviously bring a lot of expertise. They can kind of de-risk projects. There's lots and lots of big advantages of working in partnership if you want to do this kind of human-centered design work. And that would be my advice to charities, big and small, to not be scared of that collaboration.
Listen, thank you, folks. Really interesting conversation. And I think it was Peter Drucker that once said that to be a good business, you have to do good things. And I sense that we've heard a little bit about that today. If you want to hear more of the Change Management Podcast, please don't forget to follow us in the normal way. Thank you for listening. And thank you to our guest, Adam Fletcher. To find out more about this podcast and our business services at USW, please visit southwales.ac.uk/business.